Well, it's 1997, and it's the NBA Finals. The finals are tied. The series is tied 2-2, the Utah Jazz and the Chicago Bulls. Utah has home court advantage, but Chicago has Michael Jordan, the best player ever. Only one problem. A few hours before the game, or Michael Jordan has spent the last few hours before the game locked in the bathroom with flu-like symptoms. He walks to the court completely dehydrated, sensitive, and having feverish symptoms as he comes in. And at that point, you think, I'm not sure that Chicago is going to win this thing. Probably not. The first quarter, he didn't look like himself at all. He only scored 4 points. If you know anything about Michael Jordan, that is abysmally low. And he just looked like a different man, a different player. And at that point, you're thinking, this game is over. Until Michael Jordan does what Michael Jordan does. And he willed the Bulls back into the game, and they won the game by 2 after he scored 38 points. When he shot the final shot and the buzzer went off, he fell into Scottie Pippen's arms. Yeah, they were still friends then. And Scottie Pippen kind of drug him off the floor in dramatic fashion. Turned out it wasn't flu. He had flu-like symptoms. It was probably food poisoning and probably from a Domino's delivery guy in Utah because 5 guys came to deliver the pizza to him. You know, I tell you that story because it wasn't Michael Jordan's, statistically, it wasn't his best game. He shot better. He played better consistently through other games. He had scored more points in other games. His statistics and his play was better in other games. And yet, in those conditions, with a body so weak, in some ways, that game showed Michael Jordan's dominance more than any other. Because he single-handedly, under flu-like symptoms and having food poisoning and dehydrated, willed the Bulls back and willed them to win. I tell you that story because I think that dynamic is at work in this text. Jesus has died. He breathed his last. A spear has been jabbed into his side. Blood and water have flown out. He is about to be buried in a tomb, locked away. And yet it's here, I think, in those conditions and under those conditions that we see just how powerful Jesus is. I want you to see 2 things about Jesus' power in this text. I want you to see his power to draw people, and I want you to see his power to transform people. First, his power to draw people. We read about 2 men in this text, a man named Joseph of Arimathea in verse 38, and a man named Nicodemus in verse 39. The interesting thing about these men is we know that both of them were familiar with Jesus. Joseph is called, verse 38, a secret disciple. Nicodemus, we are reminded in verse 39 that we've read about him before, like back in chapter 3 and in chapter 9, I believe it was. And at these places, we know that these are men who knew about Jesus, and yet they had not fully committed to Jesus. Joseph is a secret disciple. Nicodemus comes to Jesus by night. And yet here, when Jesus' body is dead and lifeless, they come out of the shadows, and they come into the light. And what draws them? Jesus said in John chapter 12, verse 32, when the Son of Man is lifted up, I will draw all men to myself. And here, his words begin to come true. You see, it wasn't Jesus' miracles that drew Nicodemus and Joseph out of the shadows. It wasn't his teaching that drew Joseph and Nicodemus out of the shadows. No, what was it? When the Son of Man is lifted up, it was his death. Some of you are here this morning and you're interested in the teachings of Jesus. You're interested in the person of Jesus. And you think, I think Jesus has a lot of interesting things to say for living life and that kind of thing. He is, like the other great religious teachers, one of the wisest people that has ever lived. And therefore, I need to learn from him and follow him. And I want you to know this. As long as you see Jesus as simply a teacher, as long as you see him as someone who has wise sayings, as long as you see him as someone who has practical ways to live or principles, you will never understand his power. Not until you contemplate and come face to face with the implications of his death. That's what we're learning here. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians that it is Christ crucified that is the power of God and the wisdom of God. It is not Christ lecturing. It is not Christ conversing. It is Christ crucified. And that's why as a church, we always want to be about the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. That needs to be central to our message and everything that we're about. We're not just about teaching Christian truths, we're about proclaiming what God has done in Jesus Christ. That's where the power is. And if you want to know the power of Jesus, you will never understand it until you contemplate his death and his resurrection. It's Jesus' death that draws Joseph and Nicodemus. Now, who are these men? Let's consider this for a second. What do we know about them? Joseph of Arimathea. Well, we know he's well-connected because in verse 38, he has the ability to go to Pilate, who is the Roman governor at the time and friend of Caesar. He is the highest official in the land, and Joseph has the ability to get his ear. Plebes could not get Pilate's ear. Joseph has the ability to get Pilate's ear. He's well-connected. He's also very powerful. We learn elsewhere that he is a member of the ruling class. He's a part of the ruling council. So he's well-connected. He is also powerful. In fact, Pilate doesn't just entertain Joseph's request. Verse 38 tells us that Pilate, quote, gave him permission to take take Jesus to the tomb. Which brings up the other thing that we know about Joseph. He's very wealthy. Note that in verse 41, it says that Joseph, who owns the tomb, lays Jesus' body in a new tomb which no one had yet been laid. Now, if you are listening to that and you are here, you think, well, what's the big deal and why do they tell us that? And that is because most of us are Americans who live in America where land is aplenty. And you're like, don't put me in somebody else's grave. We don't do that. But have you ever been to Europe where land is not aplenty? And you're walking and you see that like four or five people are buried in the exact same spot where most people are cremated there because a burial in the ground would cost so astronomically much. Jerusalem was like that in this day. Only the wealthy could be buried in a new tomb right in the center of Jerusalem. So Joseph is astronomically wealthy. He's well-connected. He's powerful. And Nicodemus is a lot like him. Verse 39 tells us that we've already been introduced to Nicodemus in chapter 3 and, sorry, in chapter 7. Well, what do we know about Nicodemus from those places? Well, we know he's a public intellectual. Jesus calls him the teacher of Israel, which means he's an academic. And he's not just an academic, he's the teacher of Israel, all of Israel. He's a Pharisee, which means he was part of the most popular religious leading class. So he's not just an intellectual, he's a public intellectual. He's not just a public intellectual, he is also powerful and well-connected politically. He is a member of the Sanhedrin, verse 39. I'm sorry, he's a member of the Sanhedrin, we learned earlier in chapter 7. And he is also, like Joseph, very wealthy. Look at verse 39. Verse 39 says that he brings a mixture of myrrh and aloes weighing about 75 pounds. Now, We will get into this a little bit later, but you just need to know that that is a lot of money in those 75 pounds. A whole lot. So here are these men. I would consider them to be up and in. They're certainly not down and out. Which tells us something. Because if you read through the Gospels, I think that most of the time, if you read through the Gospels, you see that it is the down and out and the marginalized who are attracted to Jesus, and that is true, and that he ministers to the down and out, and he serves the down and out, and he saves the down and out, and that is true. But Jesus didn't just come for the down and out. Jesus came for the up and in as well. He came for the powerful. He came for the rich. He came for the politically connected. Why? Because they need Jesus too. They need Jesus too. In many ways, these two men are the men that we would least expect if reading through the Gospels, because they're part of the Jewish religious leadership. And if you're reading through this Gospel, you'll know that it's the Jewish religious leaders who have the biggest beef with Jesus. And yet here are the two men that we would least expect being drawn to Jesus here. Let me ask you, who do you least expect to be drawn to Jesus? Maybe it's that family member who thinks you're wasting your time at church. Maybe it's that colleague who continues to tell the crude jokes and cut corners ethically. Maybe it's that kid that you've been praying for over and over again, but they just can't seem to drift further and further away. Maybe it's that person who you walk by on the street that has gotten so accustomed to the street that you just don't think that they could ever imagine another life. Or maybe it's the billionaire who lives a mile away. Because let's be honest, most of us, if we're honest, I think the place we would least expect for revival to break out in Santa Barbara would be the Montecito Country Club or Birmingham Wood or whatever it's called, or Hope Ranch. And that's why we don't engage. That's why we don't pursue. That's why we don't strategize. That's why we don't invite, because they have everything they need except Jesus, which means they don't really have anything they need, ultimately. So let me tell you this. Jesus is drawing people to himself, the people that you least expect. So don't give up hope. And keep pursuing and inviting and praying and preaching. I got an unexpected email 2 Sundays ago. I woke up and I started to work on my sermon, and as I was putting the finishing touches on my sermon, email comes through. Never met this person before, but they write to me, "Dear Pastor Kyle, my name is John Doe." Not the real name, surprise. "I'm sorry to send you this prayer request so abruptly. I've been hearing the gospel for quite some time, but I don't think I've been regenerated, that is, born again yet. I accessed an article which told me that what true saving faith is." And then he quotes from the article. And then says, "I have the facts about Jesus. I have the comprehension of the facts about Jesus, but I don't think I trust in the facts about Jesus. I don't think I trust Jesus. Pastor, I hope you could do me a favor. Say a prayer for me now. Ask God to save my soul and grant me saving faith." That's it. Didn't ask for anything else. Hasn't asked for anything else since. No idea where this person's from. Never met them before. But I did pray for them. I have continued to pray for them. Because Jesus is drawing people to himself. People that you would never expect. So pray and pursue and preach and invite and love. You never know what Jesus is doing in somebody's life and their heart. Jesus has the power to draw people. All kinds of people. And maybe the person that you least expect Jesus to draw is you. Maybe you're here and the person that you think would be least likely to come to Jesus is you. Maybe it's because you're wealthy and you're well connected and you think, what do I need Jesus for? Jesus is for those people who have real needs. Or maybe it's because you feel like the habits and the patterns and the things you have done in your life and in your past have locked you into cycles that there is no recovering from. No, Jesus is drawing all people, the people that we least expect, even if that is you. You're here, aren't you? How do you think you got here? Why do you think you're here? You're here because Jesus is drawing you to himself. And let me tell you, what Jesus has to offer, you cannot get any other place. He comes to rescue you from death. He comes to give you forgiveness of sins. He comes to give you meaning and satisfaction and purpose. And guess what? Poverty can't disqualify you from those things, and riches can never buy you those things. But Jesus offers them to you now for free. Jesus has the power to draw people. Secondly, we see that Jesus has the power to transform people. Both Joseph and Nicodemus are transformed. Notice that the thing that we learn about Joseph, the thing that the way that he is described is he is described in verse 39 as a secret disciple. Now, why would he be a secret disciple? Well, we don't have to ask. The text tells us, for fear of the Jews. Now, when John says the Jews, he means the Jewish leadership. In other words, the people that Joseph is afraid of are his peers. Maybe he's worried that if they find out that he's sympathetic towards Jesus, that maybe he's worried that his reputation will go down. That they won't quite look at him in the same way. Maybe that means that he'll lose his connections, and he is well connected. Maybe it means that he will lose his status, and he has a great status. And maybe if you lose your status and you lose your connections, another thing that you're probably going to lose is that money. And so he is afraid. Maybe you can relate. Maybe you can relate to fear of peers finding out that you are a follower of Jesus. Maybe it's your peers at work. Maybe it's those other members in your graduate program. Maybe it's the people in your lunchroom or on your sports team. Maybe, just maybe, some of us at certain times and in certain places, we would also be labeled by John as secret disciples. Because we're afraid. But I want you to see that Joseph isn't afraid anymore. Now, something changes because he goes public in the most public way. He approaches the highest leading governing official in the land. He asks for Jesus' body, and then he takes Jesus' body. Jesus is shame-filled because he was crucified body, which would have been completely looked down upon in that society. You don't talk about crucifixion. You don't look on crucifixion. And here is Joseph saying, I'm going to identify with him. Where did he get the courage to do that? When the Son of Man is lifted up. See, I think Joseph found something. He found something in Jesus' death that he did not know before. He found love. 1 John says that perfect love drives out fear. And I think that it was the perfect love of the Son of God who loved him and who gave himself for him that made Joseph realize that he didn't need to be afraid anymore. He had found a love that crowded out the crowd. You know, the cross tells us two things at once. In one sense, when we look at the cross, what the cross does is it exposes us for who we are. The cross says that God sees everything about us, and he sees everything about us in such a way that he puts it on the cross for all to see and display. There at the cross, we are exposed. And there at the cross, we are also embraced by the God who sees us and knows everything about us. What are we afraid of? We're afraid of being exposed. But not after you're exposed and then you're embraced. Not after someone sees everything about you and that's put on display. Well, what do I have to hide anymore? And then in that place of exposure, we're hugged, received, loved, because the cross tells us that we are so bad that Jesus had to die for us. So you know what? What does it matter what people find out or know? But the cross also tells us that we are so loved and accepted that Jesus was willing to die for us. So who might you be afraid of? Family, teammates, your guild, the people who are affiliated with your political party that you think that if you identified with Jesus in certain ways, they would look down on you, you would lose reputation, you would lose connection, maybe even lose the ability to monetize things. That if you were to identify with Jesus, you might be viewed with suspicion, if not ostracized altogether, and no one wants that. No one wants that. You know, when I was a kid, I used to think that courage was kind of the thing that kids needed to go down slides, or that people needed to go off the war. As we go into our adulthood, we don't talk about courage as much as when we're little kids. People talk to us, our parents, others talk to us about being courageous and brave all the time. Not so much when we get to be adults, but you know what I would say? I'd say we need bravery and courage much more now than we did then. It just looks different. It looks like making the hard phone call, sitting with someone in suffering when you don't know what to say and entering in. It looks like engaging in conflict, but doing so with love. It looks like being vulnerable. It looks like saying you need help. It looks like confessing your sin. We need a lot of courage for those things. Where do we find this courage? We find it in the cross of Christ, where we realize that we are embraced. Nicodemus is also transformed. We're reminded that Nicodemus, when he came to Jesus, came at night. So Nicodemus is also afraid, just like Joseph. But I don't think he's afraid of peers. I really don't. I think his fear is different. The reason I don't think Joseph is afraid of peers, or Nicodemus is afraid of peers like Joseph, is because when Nicodemus comes to Jesus, if you go back to John chapter 3, and most people miss this, the first thing he says is, "We know you're a teacher that's sent from God." Nicodemus is not coming on his own. Nicodemus is coming on behalf of a we, a powerful we. Who is this we? It's his Pharisaical group. And what he is, so why is he afraid? Why is he coming at night? He's coming at night. He's coming in the dark because I believe that Nicodemus is afraid of losing power. He is afraid of the populace, because if they see Nicodemus coming to Jesus at night, if they see him ceding anything to Jesus, then what's going to happen? Well, Jesus is going to pick up a lot more power than his ruling body. And so he's got to come do backdoor politics. Not anymore. Verse 39 makes this contrast between Nicodemus earlier coming by night with how he is coming now. Now he is coming, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloe, about 75 pounds in weight. Now, what you need to know about that is some of you are like, well, I can pick up 75 pounds. I'm strong. 75 pounds in like myrrh and aloe and that kind of thing means that you have several trunks that you're carrying. So Nicodemus isn't bringing this alone. He has an entourage, which means that he is not coming at night. He is not coming under the veil of darkness. He is not coming in silence. This would have been very conspicuous. And Nicodemus doesn't care. And as an aside, it's interesting that this amount, 75 pounds in weight, would have been the amount that you would use for someone like a king. Also, as an aside, did you know this, that kings in the ancient world, when they were buried like in their tombs. You would walk in, and if you went up to their tomb, there would be lots of foliage and things like that around, because it would be a garden that was there. Verse 41. Now the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new tomb, in which no one had been laid. Maybe this isn't an aside. Maybe Nicodemus gives Jesus a burial that's fit for a king. Now think about that a second. The one who's afraid earlier of losing all his power to Jesus is now giving Jesus a burial that's fit for a king, the king that has all the power. And he's doing it at great cost to himself. Back in John chapter 12, we read about this woman who anoints Jesus for burial. And she anoints him, and she is using a vial that people think would have been about 12 ounces. And when she opens this 12-ounce vial and spills it on Jesus, I don't know if you remember the scene, but one of Jesus' disciples, Judas, he's like appalled. And remember what he says? He says, we could have sold that and had enough money for a year's worth of wages and fed the poor. So 12-ounce vial equals a year worth of wages. How much does 75 pounds worth? That's not a year's worth of wages. That's several lifetimes' wages. And Nicodemus gives it up. You know what money is? Money's power. If you have enough money, you can do what you want. Say, I can't get into the French Laundry. If you have enough money, you can. Say, no, it's booked out for a year. If you have enough money, you can buy the whole thing out. I guarantee it. I can't get there. The flights are sold out. If you have enough money, you can. You can hire your own private pilot, your own private plane, and you can get wherever you want. Money is power. And here the one who is scared of losing all his power is giving it up. Do you know what that's called? Transformation. Nicodemus is transformed by the death of Jesus. You know, I wonder why we, if you think about it, why do we, some of us, we have a really, really hard time giving away our money, and we hold on to it very tightly because it's our money and we work for it and it needs to work for us. Maybe it needs to give us security. Maybe it needs to give us efficiency in life. Why do we have a hard time giving it away? For some of us, we have a really difficult time with giving up control. And when things don't go our way, or we're not able to control the situation, we get very, very, very tense and very, very anxious when things don't go our way. Why do we get so anxious when things don't go our way or when things don't go as planned? We're afraid. Like Nicodemus was afraid. But he's not afraid anymore. Because he has found someone. He has found someone who loves him and accepts him. And he has found someone who he knows will fulfill his needs, and not only his needs, his desires. Isn't that why we're afraid when things don't go our way? Isn't that why we're afraid to give away money? Aren't we worried at the end of the day that we're going to be exposed? And if we're exposed, who is there that will take care of us, will love us, will be there for us, will provide for us and our needs, and not just our needs, but our desires? If we don't look out for ourselves at the end of the day, who will do it? So we're afraid. Nicodemus is not afraid, because he has found someone who can take care of his needs and his desires better than he ever could himself. And that gives him a freedom to let go of control, to let go of his money, to let go of these things, because he realizes that he has found Jesus, whose love is stronger than sin and stronger than death, and it's stronger than your family history, it's stronger than your bad habits, it's stronger than your pathologies, it's stronger than everything in this world. And when you know that love and the acceptance of that love, and you know that he is for you, and he will go to the point of dying on a Roman cross for you, of taking on the punishment of your sin for you, of rising again for you, then you realize that you can give up and trust him. Because his love can transform you. So the question this morning that I have for you is, will you let it? I hope you will. And God, would you give us the ability to open our arms and our hands, to loosen our grips and give up control, that you might draw us to yourself, have your way with us, and make us into the people that we know we should be and always deeply wanted to be, but only you can turn us into. Amen.